What financial companies know about today's Brexit vote that the public does not. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Some British voters had to brave severe thunderstorms today to record their votes for leaving or staying with the European Union. One theory is that lousy weather could keep younger people from voting, a demographic more inclined to vote to stay. Diane Swonk is founder of DS Economics and is anxiously watching her screens. What are you worried about?
That's one of the issues. There is a lot of uncertainty if they leave the EU. The other issue, though, is even if they don't leave, they did get a lot of concessions to stay. And that will open another can of worms for the EU to deal with all the other countries that are now leaning towards leaving.
Odd feature of today is that it's illegal in Britain to report exit polling, yet some of the big financial services firms have hired their own exit pollsters so they know that data, but the public in Britain doesn't know that.
That's exactly right, and that's one of the interesting issues. Not only do they know that data, but they can bet on it. Nearly betting on that, the money in Britain is going towards that Britain will stay.
Did you see that some hedge funds have stockpiled a bunch of money to use after the vote comes in on the quest for market dislocations they can take advantage of?
Got it. I mean, these are people who want to make money, and they want to make money any way they can, and it's not always productive in how they're betting their money, but let's face it, they're going to make money.
All right. Diane Swonk of DS Economics in Chicago, thank you for this.
Thank you.
Now, the Brits can't see these exit polls, but they can watch the stock market, and throughout much of the day, the FTSE index in London was up between 0.7% and 1.4%. Analysts see that as the London market betting the British will vote to stay in the European Union, for what that's worth. Now to healthcare and the June 12th Orlando shootings. Hospitals in the Orlando area continue to care for the wounded survivors, and while Florida has set aside special funds to help pay some of those medical bills, the money is expected to fall well short of the total tab. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Orlando Health, which runs the trauma center where victims flocked, says a number of people wounded are either uninsured or lack the insurance to fully cover their bills. The hospital system expects to pick up more than $1 million in costs. Joan Alker with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Family says that debt will likely be shifted.
Hospitals end up having severe financial problems. They transfer those costs to other payers in the system. Employers buying insurance, employees buying insurance.
While the hospital may one day be made whole by raising prices, the uninsured victims may face long-term needs that go unmet.
Usually you'll see issues related to post-traumatic stress disorder. You'll see generalized anxiety disorder, and you'll see depression.
Dr. Kermit Crawford runs the Boston Medical Center's Massachusetts Marathon Victims Resiliency Center. He says in the aftermath of a tragedy like Orlando, we must remember the mental health needs of the victims and their families. Crawford says providing people with emotional support early could stave off additional costs down the road. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This Sunday, a new wider Panama Canal opens for business. For Panama, it's a time of opportunity, of growth, but not so much for global trade, which, here's the dirty secret, never really recovered from the great financial collapse. Paul Krugman won a Nobel Prize in economics for his work analyzing world trade. He now teaches economics at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York and is a columnist for the New York Times.
The world economy is back mostly, but world trade is just not zooming the way it was.
What do you think?
We had a bunch of things that drove very fast increases in trade after about 1990. You had some technological factors. You know, containerization came into its own. The internet helps you to coordinate stuff. Some policy factors. A lot of third world countries, which had been inward looking, turned outward looking. But those were all kind of one-time events. And once they're behind you, well, you expect trade growth to slow down to sort of the pace of the economy at large. And that's what we see happening.
That's just a little under though, right?
Well, a little under, but that's and maybe. But trade had been kind of on a downslope even before, and there are a lot of people who think that was because a lot of the big innovations in transportation of that era were behind, and meanwhile, other stuff was getting more efficient. So there was a started to make sense to make more stuff at home.
I suppose some things could happen that might give the future of world trade another boost. You could get sub-Saharan Africa more open to trade, or you know, the Obama administration is looking for more trade deals, Europe and elsewhere.
Well, yeah, the thing about world trade right now and about all of these trade negotiations is that trade is almost free already. And what we call trade agreements right now tend to be really not trade agreements. You know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about intellectual property and dispute settlement and not really very much about trade, which is one of the reasons that I call myself a soft opponent. I'm not quite sure why we're doing this. So not a whole lot of frontiers to open up right now.
What about this term peak trade, Paul? We keep talking about slower growth in trade. So maybe peak trade isn't exactly the right word?
I don't think that's the right way to think about it. The right way to think about it is that although historically, typically, technological progress has led to more trade, that doesn't have to happen. If you get better at making stuff and not better at shipping stuff, then actually countries are going to turn inward a little bit. So there's no law that says that trade has to always grow faster than the world economy. And we may be now entering we're talking about maybe 5 years of evidence. We're trying to extrapolate for decades. But it may be that we're entering an era when trade becomes a bit less of a thing.
Paul Krugman, economist, Nobel Prize winner, professor of economics at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and New York Times columnist. Thank you.
Thank you.
At Marketplace Digital, marketplace.org, there's more of my conversation with Dr. Krugman, including how the slowdown in trade is affecting American workers, plus all of our series from Panama on the new canal in the context of this dwindling trade growth, last-ditch effort, we're calling it. This morning, I also tweeted a stunning graphic readout of all ocean commerce lighting up the world's oceans today. It's also on the Marketplace site now. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.